Welcome to another episode of the How to Save the World podcast, where we take a deep intellectual dive into the academic research and behavioral science of what really gets people to take pro-environmental action and behavior. I'm your host, Katie Patrick. I'm an environmental engineer and a designer based in Silicon Valley, California, and I'm the author of the book, How to Save the World. If you haven't already, sign up to my website at katiepatrick.com to get more free resources about how you can use gamification and behavior design to get your community to zero emissions and make it fun like a game. Today's guest on the podcast is Nicole Sintov. She's an associate professor of behavior, decision-making, and sustainability from Ohio State University. We'll be interviewing Nicole on her published research paper titled Guilt Consistently Motivates Pro-Environmental Outcomes While Pride Depends on Context. So what does this guilt versus pride mean when we're talking about environmental behavior academic research? The gist of this research shows that telling people they are performing worse than most other people on environmental and climate action or behavior actually stimulates people to have better environmental performance. That's right. Giving people a bit of negative feedback, making them feel a little bit guilty, saying they're doing worse than average leads to better outcomes. We'll dig into this question. Should we be showering people with compliments and positive feedback and smiley faces and love hearts about their good, eco-friendly efforts? Or are we just better telling people only when they are doing a bad job? It's not a completely black and white thing. Nicole shows us that we don't need to only be making people feel guilty and bad, but that negative feedback often gets a bad rap and tends to be avoided because we usually want to be positive and supportive. But her research shows that there is definitely a strong role for this negative and guilt-driven feedback and that it needs to be a tool in our toolbox of change. I gravitated to this paper and wanted to get in touch with Nicole because I had had this same experience when showing people their own carbon emissions in the different apps and Chrome extensions that I've been developing. I started to notice that when you told people that they were doing worse than average or gave them these negative infused colors like orange or red, that people's ears seemed to really perk up and they started to get quite worried and disturbed that they were shown to be these poor environmental performers. Whereas the people that were doing really well, they were coming in first as the lowest carbon emission person. They got green, they got all the friendly smiling earths. I would ask them, how motivated are you to change your behavior? And they would say, well, I don't really need to change anything because I can see by looking at your app that I'm doing great. And in our other episode about using colored light to motivate energy efficiency, Professor Jap Ham also showed that showing people the red light and the negative smiling faces was the most powerful way to nudge people to change their energy-related behavior. So if you're working on an environmental campaign or app or product or program that involves communicating to people about their performance, don't be too afraid about letting people know when they are doing worse than average, when they are the poorer performers. It could be one of the most powerful tools you have to actually get those lower performers to start to change. Now let's jump into the episode with Associate Professor of Behavior Decision Making and Sustainability, Nicole Sintov. Welcome to the show, Nicole. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, great to be here.
What I start these conversations off with is that we have this problem in the environmental profession and all the people that are working as sustainability managers in cities and climate tech startups, working in governments and often working in big international organizations like the European Commission or the United Nations. And most of us in our environmental profession have never heard of environmental psychology and tend to not view the work we do through a psychological lens. Why is this a problem for our industry and movement?
I think it's a missed opportunity because, as you pointed out during our earlier conversations, there is this body of knowledge that's constantly growing and evolving. And this science practice gap that you're pointing out means that, or for whatever reason, and this is an area of research into itself, there's difficulty in getting that body of knowledge out to the public, to people who are using it, to people who could be implementing the lessons we're learning in science, which is a missed opportunity. We're investing resources and time, and people are dedicating their careers to improving sustainability in the real world. And they could be doing it with this additional knowledge that we have from the scientific community.
It's really amazing, like, how much knowledge is there and how powerful these insights are. I find it can be really disturbing to see how many mistakes our profession makes. When you start to read this research, you think, oh, if you just did that slightly differently, and I think if you worded that differently, and if you did that. Another guest that I interviewed explained it in this way. It can be the difference between your campaign or your project having no effect at all, like a complete fail, or it having like a 30 or a 50% increase. Just these like subtle differences in the way that we display the information and we display the wording, which, you know, we can sort of extract from these studies. So let's jump into your research. What was the one big lesson or the one big aha message that you got out of it?
Well, can I do two? Replicating prior findings that we ourselves have worked on, we see again that there is this role for guilt in promoting pro-environmental behavior and motivating people to act more sustainably. I think this is significant because we as a society tend to shy away from shaming people, for lack of a better term, or telling them they're doing a bad job. That's not a comfortable thing to do. We don't like to do that. And I'm not necessarily advocating that we go ahead and do that all the time, but I am saying that based on our findings and findings of a prior paper we worked on, that can be beneficial in some scenarios. So that's the one thing. The other thing is that we had hypothesized differences between anticipating feeling guilt and how that impacts your behavior later and experiencing that guilty feeling. So actually feeling it in the moment and seeing what effects that might have. And we didn't see any differences between the anticipated and experienced emotions. And I should also say that in addition to anticipated versus experienced on guilt, we also looked at that for pride and similarly didn't see differences.
Can you explain what you mean by these words guilt and pride? Because the way you use them in a testing model and the way you've used them in this experiment is quite different to the way we might use them in our general colloquial language. What do you mean exactly by how you would define these words pride and guilt?
We, in our experiment, attempted to evoke feelings of guilt and pride through feedback. So in the first study, we had people fill out a carbon footprint quiz, a home energy quiz, essentially online. Then we gave them feedback, the experienced people that is, that were assigned to the experienced feedback groups on how they did. It was framed such that you're doing a bad job, you're using more than other people, you're not behaving sustainably, or you're doing really well, you're performing better than everyone else. And so after receiving one or the other of those messages or one of the experienced emotions messages, and I'm kind of putting those aside because they're a little more complex and challenging to explain, but just focusing on how we kind of evoked these emotions, we gave that feedback and then we assessed how people felt afterwards using self-report scales. So right now, to what extent do you feel proud, regretful, guilty, remorseful, pleased with myself? We saw that our manipulations did work. So people who received the negative messages felt way more guilty than people who received the positive messages, and vice versa for feelings of pride.
I more or less interpret the findings of your study and the way that you tested it is that if you basically tell people that they're doing worse than average, so this sense of guilt, it's not necessarily just like some deeply moody, like emotional campaign. Because I think when people first see the word guilt, they just think of just the emotion without the actual technical side and the pride, you know, just in this qualitative sense. What you mean is specifically sort of trying to get like a measurement, like a feedback loop of measurement that is also socially comparative. So these things are quite sort of technical and sort of data driven in terms of the context of guilt. So one is guilt is telling people you're doing worse than average. We've measured you, we've compared you to everybody else, and you're doing worse than average. And the pride message is we've measured you and we're telling you you're doing better than average. Do you think my understanding has completely encapsulated it, or is there more to it than just feedback and social comparison?
That pretty much sums it up. But I would distinguish between the feedback message itself and the response that evokes in us.
Okay, so the response it evokes. So when we give people like a negative feedback message that you're doing worse than average, that evokes like a guilty feeling. That's the kind of, evokes a guilty feeling, and that drives us then to take action more than perhaps feeling a pride feeling. What I thought was really interesting when I was reading your paper is we talk about environmental psychology on this podcast. So we always talk about the value action gap. It comes up. It's in everything, all the work I do. I talk about it a lot. I mean, you know what the value action gap is. Just taking an education approach doesn't necessarily lead to people taking action. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that, but with a kind of a nuance that I saw in your paper, which is, could you dig into like the causal mechanism behind that? Because your paper mentions that when we trigger emotion, we trigger a different type of cognitive processing, a different type of concentration and focus than perhaps if we're just taking like an intellectual approach that perhaps doesn't include emotion. This is the, let's just educate people about climate change. And if everybody knows what the parts per million are in the atmosphere, everybody will act. This purely kind of cognitive, sort of scientifically rationalist approach, which is largely proven to not really work that well. I mean, I would just love it if you could dig into this sort of causality and this cognitive processing side of why triggering the emotion works to drive action and just triggering the intellect doesn't work as well.
That's funny that you bring this up because it's like the number one takeaway from my undergraduate course. And I'm just like hitting him over the head with it all semester.
Oh, great. I'm great. So, so glad to have you be able to please explain, ramble, just go. Deep. I
Well, I don't know why this is, but we do tend to think as a society that people just knew X, Y, or Z, they would behave in this way. And research across dozens and dozens of domains, if not hundreds, has shown that that's just not the case most of the time. I would say that emotion is one factor that can motivate behavior, and it is part of a package of motivators. We're complex beings, and our behavior is predicted by a whole multitude of different things. And I don't know why emotion can be seen as a novel predictor. It's such a core part of who we are and how we operate. And actually, coming from my background, I was a clinical psychologist. That's what my background training is in. And there is a model where you link thoughts, behaviors, and feelings. And it's supposed that you are going to be able to intervene on the level of behaviors and thoughts, but not necessarily on emotions. Emotions are like maybe the outcome in that model. And so when people are feeling depressed or they're feeling anxious or just other unpleasant feelings that they want to resolve, how do you resolve that? Well, you can do it by changing your thoughts. So from a clinical perspective, we can have these schemas where we're constantly giving ourselves like negative self-talk, like I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm not this, I'm not that, et cetera. In order to stop that, you can do this cognitive restructuring task. I won't get into that because that's not what this research is about. But another thing you can do, which does relate to this research, is you can change what you're doing, and changing what you're doing can change how you feel. Whereas in this project, you know, we kind of look at the opposite direction, whereby we look at how feeling a certain way can influence how we behave. It's kind of a cycle. And that's just like philosophically the lens through which I view all of this. If we change our behaviors, we can change how we feel. And that might be the underlying motivator here. If we feel guilty and we want to get rid of that feeling, well, one way to do that is by changing what we do, by engaging in actions to like make up for whatever wrongdoing we think that we've done, for instance. On the other hand, if we feel proud, then we're like, oh, we're doing great. Like there's no need to change what I'm doing. Versus if we think there's an opportunity to feel proud, that should in theory be motivating because we have to do something in order to attain that feeling of pride in the future. We didn't find support for that in this study, which is when I said one of the main takeaways, we didn't see the difference between the experienced and anticipated emotions conditions. But just from a theoretical lens, we would expect that anticipated pride should be motivating. And it may be in other contexts and circumstances that we just didn't observe in our particular research.
Yeah, I can see how this sense of like sort of future anticipated pride, which means like if I do this thing, like in the future, I'll feel really good about it. So I'm kind of projecting my imagination forward in time. Or if I do this thing, I'll feel really bad about it. That these could be quite different depending on the types of environmental behaviors, because they can be so different. Like if you're looking at just saving a bit of electricity versus, you know, using some plastic, or perhaps like redoing your entire garden into a permaculture garden, I would think if I projected my mind forward and thinking like, should I spend $5,000 on a total like permaculture landscaping thing? Like I would think the pride would be pretty strong with something like that, really material and substantial. But if it's maybe like, well, how would I feel if I like change the light bulb? It might not be very strong. So I think that's why we have to be so specific with the behaviors and really sort of categorize them up and see, you know, like recycling is different to energy, which is different to getting involved in politics, which is different to, you know, saving water, which, you know, Mary on the call specializes in. But they really kind of all need their own behavioral action design.
If I could jump in on that, like that's a really important point and one that we as a field continue to grapple with. And I will admit that I'm guilty of it. I'm guilty of it in this paper, you know, no pun intended with the guilt there, that we tend to like combine behaviors into these gross scales of a bunch of different things. Are you saving water at home? Are you saving energy at home? Did you walk instead of taking a single occupancy vehicle? And we gather up all those things together and call it a scale of pro-environmental behavior. And that's what we did in the study as well. We had a second study where we measured actual donations to an environmental cause. But a lot of the research does still treat these behaviors as homogenous, even though we all know they're not. But I do think it's really important to emphasize that each behavior is unique, and thinking about things as how to get people to behave more sustainably, like that's just not a question that you should be asking, because the answer is going to be, it depends. It depends on the behavior in part, and it depends on a whole lot of other things as well.
It's my biggest challenge and bugbear, and what takes up a lot of my practical design work is exactly that thing. It's like teasing these products. It's like this big matted bit of hair, or like all these kind of braids, and you've got to like tease it out and tease it out. And I think everybody, and I'll say everybody, I'm really thinking through, like, am I using everybody accurately? Can I think of any examples where people had a bias towards being more niche? I'm pretty sure every single person has a bias towards adding more braids in, or we want to do more, we want to do more actions, or we can't, you know, we don't want to get people to do energy, but we can't leave out like eating, you know, less meat and flying, like, or we can't leave out like going down to your local city or writing a letter, or what about, you know, like doing it for your job? And then suddenly it's like all the things. And this desire, this bias towards this desire to be kind of comprehensive. Like we're not being accurate if we're not being comprehensive. So let's be comprehensive and let's bring it all together. And then when you're actually trying to figure out how to like, so I'm working like as a behavior designer, being like, okay, well, how do we actually get the human in their real home, in their life, to actually do this thing or buy this product? You can't just be like, oh, here's like all the things in the universe you could possibly do. And that teasing it out is just so important. And the resistance people have is profound. Like, it, I mean, really, I have my own personal resistance. When I have to do it, I'm just like, no, I mean, I feel the bias myself, and I see it in everyone else, everyone like I coach and I teach and does consulting with me. They're like clinging, like, but I must ask people to do all the things at once. And it's like, we all have this bias. It's like crazy. And also because I do this professionally, like I'm consulting to so many different people in groups. I see the same pattern just over and over again. It's almost like become like my life's work to help people, like just being like, it's okay to niche. It's okay. Like the world's not going to end. Just, it's fine. Just do one action at a time.
In fact, you may be more successful if you do that.
It's actually another guy I'm hoping to get on the podcast who did a research paper. It may have come out in the same edition that your paper came out, which is exactly on this thing, like why giving people like lots of things doesn't work, and when you give people less things to do. So hopefully I'll get him on next month. But let's move into, what about pride and moral licensing? This thing comes up, like this tension between the spillover effect and the moral licensing effect, that when you tell people they're doing a good job, their environmental performance actually gets worse. What do you think about that?
So I have a student, Sam Mertens, who is working on this idea of consistency or lack of consistency. And so one of the things she's thinking about is, what's the valence of the first behavior that people engage in to start the spillover process? that's been somewhat neglected as like a very focused topic of research. So nobody steal it because it's going to be part of our dissertation. I mean, we have seen a lot of studies showing positive spillover. So, you know, you engage in one pro-environmental behavior and then you engage in another pro-environmental behavior. And there are lots of mechanisms that can connect the two. One of the most robust being environmental identity gets like made more salient. Let's say you walk to work instead of driving your car. You feel really good about that. You know, I'm this environmental person. I've done something good for the environment. I behaved consistently with my identity. And then at lunch, you know, maybe you get like a salad instead of a burger or something like that if you're trying to cut down on meat. That's important to you. So that's one way it can go. But the other thing that could happen is you walk to work and then you're like, I've done my part. Now I'm going to eat all the beef at lunchtime. I guess there's a couple things here. One of which is in recent years, there's been failures to replicate the moral licensing effect across a variety of domains, but also in the pro-environmental domain, whereby that effect just isn't happening. The other thing that I would say just connected to Sam's research is when we're looking at that mechanism, we're always starting with like a positive pro-environmental behavior. But what if we start with you do something bad? Maybe it is like that you drive to work. So then how does that set you off on a different path after that? Do you morally cleanse and then eat the salad for lunch because you felt guilty about driving? Or are you like, okay, well, I guess I'm not an environmental person, at least for today, because I drove. So I'm also going to eat all the beef at lunch. That is positive spillover. You're still being consistent in a sense, but consistent in the quote unquote bad way.
I haven't heard that word moral cleansing before. Is that like a technical term that is the mm-hmm. opposite of moral licensing?
More or less, yeah. Yep.
Okay. Just to get to the definitions right for everybody. Emotional valency, this came up in another interview we did on a guy who studied, a neuroscientist who studied the effect of looking at negative pictures of climate change versus climate solutions. And so when we're digging into this idea of valency, the positive, the negative emotions, can you just explain what valency means in environmental behavior psychology?
Yeah. I mean, the way that I think about it is, at least in this context, is the thing, the behavior, let's say, something that's environmentally beneficial? Is it positive? Is it consistent with how you view yourself or not? Things in the positive valence for me, I can take me as an example, would be not driving, not online shopping, resisting consumptive activities. That would be positive valence things for me. Negative valence things for me would be like engaging in those behaviors. So like doing the online shopping, ordering to-go food in plastic containers with disposable cutlery, driving, et cetera, consuming, doing things that have a negative impact on the environment. To me, I would call those the negative valence behaviors.
So it's whether something feels positive or negative to you, like your subjective sense of what is perhaps positive or negative. Is it just like positive to negative valence, or can it be other things? Can it be like angry to aggressive to like passive, or which direction do these valences go?
I guess I hadn't thought about it in that holistic of a sense. I just thought positive to negative.
And just spill over again, just so we can get the definition right. I know you mentioned it before, but just in a nutshell, what is environmental spillover?
This is another one that there's some disagreement in the literature about. The way that I define it is the influence of one behavior on a subsequent behavior that may not be an obvious behavior to be connected to the first. The example I provided, driving to work, and then what do you eat for lunch? But the reality is a lot of behaviors intervened in that time. Right? So I drove to work and then I worked for some amount of time. Maybe I ordered something online. Who knows what I did? But we're talking about drawing a connection between like some behavior that we pluck out of the ether and then a behavior that happens later in time that is similarly plucked out of the ether.
I thought it was interesting that you said that the moral licensing has been failed to replicate as much, because I'm really suspicious of the moral licensing. And I feel like it kind of gets bracketed in with this argument of like, oh, like individual actions don't matter because we need to change the system. That kind of like argument of like, why do we even look at individual people when we need to change the system? which seems to be more of a political ideology, perhaps more than a strategy, although it's not completely black or white. And then that argument will kind of heavily lean on. I actually know one person who was doing a PhD who heavily leaned on that, like, we should actively not get people to do environmental behaviors because we need to change the system. Mm-hmm. And therefore, every time we ask people to do pro-environmental behavior, we're actually harming the change of the system, because by doing little things, they're not going to do big things. And I never personally bought that argument, even though he was a really smart guy and a good friend. My sense is that everything is moving in the direction of spillover. That's just my sort of intuitive sense from what I see around me, that when you encourage people to adopt a pro-environmental attitude, they start taking it on. And then I just see it in my life of people adopting things, and then one thing leads to another, then they start reading books, and then you start getting really into it. And I just don't feel that I see a sense of, oh, like, I took a short shower, so now I'm going to go to McDonald's. Although I have kind of seen it a bit in the research. I mean, do you feel that too, that there's way more spillover and this moral licensing is a little bit of like a red herring?
I don't know what to think. I mean, there's evidence for both. It's certainly interesting to see a failure to replicate in the literature. I think it's important that people continue to try and replicate prior studies to see if the effects are observed. It could be a contextual thing. So you're saying you see this in your life, but you're obviously a very pro-environmental person. Maybe you have other friends that you keep around just to be like, well, what does the competition do? We surround ourselves with people who are similar to us. So anecdotally, we're more likely to see things that are consistent with our worldviews. If I, you know, push came to shove, I would probably say that moral licensing is a real effect and does occur, but it's probably limited to certain contexts and to certain populations, certain types of people.
And I also feel that the academic studies, they can't easily measure the way the overall zeitgeist or social norm of society as a whole is changing from decade to decade, unless they're like specifically looking at that thing over a long time. So 20 years ago, like, the exact study on a moral licensing may bring like a different result, or any study can give a different result, just because that's kind of like where the culture was at back then. And then you do the same thing 20 years later, and then it will have like a different effect. And I've noticed this with the vegetarian and vegan studies. There's a whole bunch of studies that say, like, if you label foods, you know, being vegetarian or vegan, they kind of like make people order less because people don't identify themselves as being vegan or vegetarian, and actively using these words actually sort of puts people off, because most people are meat eaters. But then I've noticed these other studies showing the opposite, that they actually seem to like encourage people, and they, by putting like, you know, logos or whatever kind of incentives that things are lower meat, are encouraging people. And so I think it's not so much that, like, is one study wrong and is one study right, but that the culture has shifted over these decades where these things are more desirable over time. That's why I think the academic studies don't necessarily take into that slow moving sort of lava of just the overall cultural zeitgeist. Do you see that as well?
That's a very astute observation, and academics could study that as part of like a meta-analysis, for instance, where you are interested in some effect, let's say labeling things as vegetarian or vegan on a menu, and does that increase or decrease people's likelihood of ordering? If we were to like do a meta-analysis of that effect over time, we could see that like whatever studies were done decades ago, maybe we see a trend line in how the effect changes over time. And I would be shocked if things really flipped one direction to another. You certainly are going to see changes as the culture evolves. Any one academic study is unlikely to capture that. You know, how do you capture that?
Well, if you've kind of been in this scene for long enough, you know, like you notice it. Like when I was telling people I was a vegetarian when I was 14 years old, which would have been in like 1993, 1994. Like it was really different to saying it then. Like it was really weird. It was like countercultural. Like it was had all these associations with being this really sort of like fringe hippie freak thing. People were quite rude about it. They tease you. Restaurants usually never had any vegetarian options. Vegetarian restaurants were weird if they existed at all. Even now, like this whole like vegan vegetarian thing is all this fake meat. Like it's a totally different cultural space now than it was 25 years ago. Remember back and you think, well, if you were testing those things then and then, I mean, there's been like just a huge change. And it's like that across like so many other social things.
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian for 30 years. And mm-hmm. I mean, the evolution of that whole space is just astronomical. And 30 years is not that long in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, yeah. And you also see the same thing with gay rights, like this very, very rapid flip in the culture from anything to do with being LGBTQ, any kind of like homosexuality was illegal and reviled and really, really sort of had to be hidden, to it becoming this big, maybe mainstream is not the best word, but largely I think mainstreamly sort of accepted and popularized movement, and then having it go through to become, have gay marriage become legal. I mean, that's a pretty like short period of time to go from how bad it was to how largely acceptable and even celebrated it is now. And I think people forget when they're working on these things that we're not necessarily talking about like a 1 year slice in time. We're talking about maybe a 25 year or 50 year slice in time to kind of expand our horizon in sort of making these like cultural effects ripple through.
Yeah, very interesting.
Okay. So when I teach game design for sustainability, and I design apps myself, one of the main things I focus on is the reward center of the brain, that you get people to do something and then you have to like give the brain a cookie. You did it. Good job. Thumbs up. It's like a key slide in my lecture presentation. From your research, it kind of looks like that's wrong. Like, am I doing it wrong? The idea that you have to give this positive feedback, good job, give the brain a cookie, love hearts, all this stuff we see in games to get people to progress through an action. How do you reconcile this feature, which is really real in sort of action design, that you take people to a goal and then you do the thumbs up, the love hearts, good job, positive feedback, with your results that said that that stuff is ultimately not going to necessarily encourage more behavior?
Well, I think it's important to consider the context. We did see that evoking guilt was successful in promoting pro-environmental intentions across two different contexts in this particular paper. The first context is maybe more similar to a game scenario, or sorry, the second context is more similar to a game whereby the people did one action. They voted for a company and then were told the company was either a big polluter or not. That resulted in, you know, them feeling guilty and then making a donation. But the opposite also occurred in that context, whereby if we told them, oh, the company's not a polluter, then they felt proud and they were also more likely to make a donation after feeling proud. So when it was just based on a single action, the positive feedback and the feeling proud in the moment both led to more donations. So in that like single action environment, we saw a role for both guilt and pride, versus in the first study of the paper, we were focused more on people's lifestyles. So how are you behaving in your home? What's your energy bill? This and that. And on the basis of your lifestyle, you're polluting. Another difference between the contexts, of course, is that it's about your lifestyle and your behaviors versus you voted for this company, which you voted for them, but you're not the one responsible for their decisions. So there's a little, you know, degree of removal there.
Did the second one have the social comparison in? Was it comparing you to everybody else as well?
The second one compared companies to other companies. You could vote for one of two companies, and we either said this company pollutes a lot more than companies of a similar size, or it pollutes a lot less.
Okay. Because this is my next question, is that the effect of the guilt message, which is when you tell people they're doing basically worse than average or worse than 85%, the way you've worded it, is the causal effect, do you think, all about the social comparison? Is it like I'm worse than average and it humans intensely do not want to be lower performing than the group? But if you gave the negative effect that perhaps wasn't comparative to everybody else, that was perhaps just comparative to your own history, or maybe it wasn't comparative, but just says you're sort of doing bad, will it still work? Is it all about the social comparison? Is that the real tripwire that we want to really like trigger in people?
We can't say based on these results, but my intuition is that it's not all about the social comparison. Of course, that's a part of it, but I think we can all relate to just receiving like a bad signal, a negative signal about ourselves, regardless of any sort of like comparison to our past or to others. We don't like receiving bad feedback.
The negative feedback will probably work whether it's socially comparative or not. I've noticed I've done a lot of user testing of different energy display apps and stuff, also interviewing different game designers on the podcast. And what I noticed, what the other game designers mentioned, and what I also noticed in my own testing, was that it seems to change by personality type. And when the game designers, because game designers go like really, really deep into this UI stuff, like in a way that if we're just sort of discussing it theoretically, we don't go, it's more deep theoretically, they're more deep in the sort of like practical application side of it, but they actually like design different pathways and different mechanisms to suit these different personality types. I noticed through like a very deep kind of qualitative testing, which is basically having like a 90-minute screen share phone call with somebody about their experience, that some people were intensely affected by the social comparison. Like they're like straight to the leaderboard. How do I compare to other people? And I'm like watching them real time. This is the first time that they've seen it. They're like, really? Really? What? They're like, I'm worse. Are you serious? I'm like, who is that person? Like, can you put me in touch with Brad and Dave? In the hand, even some people were just like this, like, and I was like, wow, they're getting like really affected by this. And other people were not at all. Actually, everybody who I knew was an engineer or a scientist, they were like straight into the data. They were like, can I open this up into 5 more charts? Because I really want to like look into the data. And I said, you know, don't you worry about the social comparison. They're like, I don't care what other people are doing. I just want to know my data, that sort of deep look. And then other people were just affected in a more like simple way of just like, oh yeah, that's good. Oh, that's bad. Yeah. Okay. I'll do something. But I really noticed this quite stark difference between the people that were intensely driven by the social comparison and some people just totally like not at all, still motivated, but there were different features of the app that really drove them. And it made me think that, you know, if I was doing like a sort of a version 2, I would find a way of helping those people kind of like self-select into different types of designs. Like one would be very data driven, maybe one would be very like emoji smiley reward, cute strawberry, you did the thing sort of reward mechanism, you know, get all the badges sort of style of people. Mm-hmm. And one that was like very, very like competition based, how you mm-hmm. you compare, and then having like slightly different designs for those different types. Have you come across like personality studies like that in your work?
I have not, but that's a very interesting observation. I'm sure that there are people studying people's need for cognition. Well, I know that that's an area of study, need for cognition, like being into the graphs and just wanting to know what's happening with the data. And then another individual difference characteristic, as we would call them as psychologists, I guess for lack of a better term, personality characteristics that vary across people. This need to compare to others, this competitiveness, that's certainly a trait that we can all think of examples in our own lives. Someone's more or less competitive than you.
And I find the people who are often the first port of call for designing this stuff in the real world are all engineers, because they're the people who are usually working on the sustainability stuff, but like the energy utilities and the cities and the buildings. And so it's a lot of this stuff like in the real world has been designed up by the highly analytical minded people. And they're like, hey, look at like these 10 charts at all once. Isn't it obvious? And you're like, no, not to most people. And then it kind of like gets a bit stuck there. So there isn't necessarily like the seed of all this stuff has come from the highly analytical personality type. So it's not necessarily being converted into the more playful, reward-driven social comparison personality types, which are probably more of them, I would say, make up more of society.
Yeah.
So if somebody was rolling out like a campaign, say it's about energy. Say if I was working with a utility and I wanted to tell people that they were more polluting than other people, do you think it would be a reasonable strategy to just carve out the bottom 50%, completely ignore the top performers, and just only communicate negative feedback to the bottom performers and just completely ignore everybody else?
I often ask myself a related question, which is that do we even focus on the bottom performers at all? I tend to think no, just from a resources perspective. We have limited resources to tackle society's problems, and the people who are performing the worst just may require a lot of intervention and effort and possibly not give us much of an ROI. I don't know if that was totally your question though. Even if we just get rid of, let's say, the bottom 10%, should we just focus on like percentile 10 to 50? Maybe, because there's more room to change. That's certainly one strategy. But then, you know, you want the top performers to continue performing well. So there's also that side of it. We're not living in a static world. Things can change. And you want the people who are doing well to continue doing well. You want to support that.
So we don't necessarily want to do a strategy that only ever tells people they're doing badly and completely ignores people that are doing well.
Nah.
Because I was thinking of pitching that to the utility. I'm like, let's just like stop all the positive feedback stuff. Let's just choose a whole bunch of people that are doing badly, save our resources, go really hard at them, give them the negative feedback. You're doing worse than average. You're in the bottom 10%. And just carve out this section and only do that rather than try to give something that's going to kind of like work for everybody, you know, where they're at.
Yeah, I think it's always important to keep in mind that things are dynamic, things are changing in real time. And just because somebody is, you know, at a certain level today, who knows where they'll be tomorrow and what you can do to guide them along the path you want to guide them along.
There was another study that I came across that did a leaderboard, put everybody on a leaderboard. And they came out saying that they felt that the leaderboard approach wasn't the best approach. It wasn't a completely black and white answer. They said it was good in a certain sort of sense, depending on how you do it, but it was actively demotivating for people. So my question for you is there a degree, do you sense, of negative feedback where it stops working? Like if you say, like you're doing this other study clearly found that if you're at the top of the leaderboard, it was super motivating. Like you're in the top five. But once you got after that top five, I think it had no effect. And then the bottom ones were just like did worse. Like they just like really demoralizing, checked out. So it was kind of like this anti idea of using leaderboards, or I don't know, just showing them to the top performers and sort of hiding them from everybody else, like something like that. Do you get a sense that there's like a range of negative feedback that is optimal, but you don't want to go like too far?
We haven't looked at that, but we have talked about at what point does repeated negative feedback become overwhelming and just turn people off? I don't know what the answer to that question is, but certainly people are going to be flooded after a certain point and you're going to be at odds with your goals. I just don't know what that point is. I don't think science has answered that question yet.
Well, it takes a lot of user testing to dig into it. Mary's got a few comments there. Mary, did you want to ask a question of Nicole? And hi, Steve. Thanks for joining.
Hi.
Yeah, this is fascinating. I mentioned the Department of Energy has this community-based social marketing model where they engage through a local leader to orchestrate change by bringing in their peers. But I taught Dale Carnegie for quite a while, and I was quite shocked at their approach. We could not give any negative feedback because people, when it's one-on-one, they build trust and they have enough fear in themselves that you have to focus. I like what Nicole just said about, you know, what's working, build on what's working, you know, use everyone else to point the people to who's working. And then by not pointing out anything negative, you don't reinforce the negative, and you also build confidence that people aren't going to have their dirty laundry exposed. So would it be true that this negative feedback is more in the form of a chart, not something one-to-one personal, versus if you're doing one-to-one, you have to build positive because that creates trust and rapport?
Our study shows that sometimes guilt is motivating. And so I know that's a very unpopular thing to do from an organizational perspective. No utility that I've ever worked with would really be down with giving people negative feedback on their carbon footprint, saying like, you're doing really terribly. You know, we have the O-Power saying your neighbors are doing better than you, but like, keep it up. So there's ways of like caveating the negative feedback, I guess, to soften the blow, if you will. Our work shows though that guilt can be motivating. And so it's just something to consider in a larger toolbox of things that you can use to promote change.
Yeah. I think the social norming charts and things, you know, that you receive through an anonymous letter are definitely motivating. My husband and I always say like, why are we showing up here? But no, everyone wants to measure up, but thank you, ladies. Really interesting. Appreciate your research.
Hey, Nicole, can I ask a question?
Sure.
We did an effort here in my community to both reduce carbon footprint and reduce water consumption. And I felt like the situation broke down. It was over a year period. It seemed like there were three different types of people. and a different message required for the three. The first group was highly motivated already. They just wanted to know where they were. They were impervious to criticism. They were like, you know, tell me where I am. Tell me how I'd get better. You know, go. So that was easy. But then of the people who were doing poorly, they bifurcated. So there were the people who said, oh my God, I had no idea I was doing this badly. And I had no idea I could do better easily. Thank you for the information. And then they went off and did stuff. And that was good. Whereas the other group of people were like, you know, get away from me. I don't care. You know, this is negative. I don't like you. I don't like this. I don't, you know, whatever. So did your research show that there was a need for, or that the message resonated differently with different groups, and that it made sense to have a different message? Sort of to Katie's point, I think the negative information would land differently on that bottom sector. There are some people that would be motivated to get better and other people who wouldn't. So did you get into any of that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So I think what you're talking about relates to what we refer to in my field as reactance. It's when you present someone with feedback or some other sort of communication that evokes a really negative response in them. And it sounds like that's what happened in the scenario you were describing. In our research, we did not include a measure of reactance. We didn't look for that. It was an experiment. So we kind of just saw like what happened for everybody in that experimental group on average. It's totally possible that there's a subset of folks that exhibited reactance and are not going to respond well to a negative message. And that's one reason why people in general can be against using the negative messaging, because it can evoke reactance, and that's not good for anyone.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. It sounds like there's more to the study here to understand how to tune the message and make it optimally effective.
Mm-hmm. The depth never ceases to amaze me, Steve, in my designs and podcast interviews and reading these studies, like the glossary of terms, the nuances, like it's like it just goes deeper and deeper. Mary or Steve, did you want to add anything else for Nicole?
I just am putting into the chat a neat research piece done on demand management in Chapel Hill by A.R. El-Khattabi, who's now with the economic group of EPA. Confirmed your findings, Nicole, that demand management is motivated by social norming, which has to do with guilt. But it also showed that if you had like water efforts or local movements, like wherever there was a water cluster, one of these innovation hubs, you saw a lot more activity, like in San Francisco or like in Austin, Texas. It was very interesting how the local awareness worked hand in hand. Some of his stuff might be useful to you guys. Finally, just a question on the negativity. Aren't we prone from just how we're created for survival purposes to look at what's not working? And the what's working is sort of frosting on the cake. But if we know what's not working or a problem area, we can defend and survive. So is this something that's like genetically wired?
Yes, it's called the negativity bias. It's the fact that we turn our attention to negative stimuli more than we do neutral or positive stimuli. And you're right, it's a survival mechanism. It's evolutionarily beneficial. If there's something in our environment that's going to threaten us, that could kill us, et cetera, it's advantageous to attend to that stimulus so that we can avoid it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was cool to learn the word reactance. I haven't heard that before, but my hunch is from following what these utilities have been doing with this stuff and hearing about this problem with like, oh, we don't want to give people negative feedback. Is there a thing called reactance bias, like institutional reactance bias, where a couple of people freak out, like Steve said, they're really negative about it. They're like, oh my God, how dare you give me like a frowny face? I can't handle being this negative information. And then everybody in the institution, the organization, the government or the utility or the city, in their mind, it's 100 times bigger than it really is. It's like one negative voice somehow suddenly is everybody. And then like, oh, we got like three negative letters, so therefore we can't implement this very effective strategy. Do you think that happens kind of like a meta negativity bias? Because I got the sense that that's what was going on. Okay, you get a few people angry, but then they throw the baby out with the bathwater because the institution can't tolerate the negative feedback. So they all go like super, super nice.
Yeah, I can think of a lot of examples where we see that. I don't know that there's a term coined for it. I'm not familiar, but I think you should coin the term, Katie.
Yeah. Well, what should I call it? Should it be called institutional reactance bias?
Sure.
Does that say it properly? Okay. Institutional reactance bias. I'll make a little like LinkedIn little animation or something and then tag all the people I know at utilities and see what they have to say.
I would think this has to do with the negativity bias as well. Just the fact that we attend to negative stimuli in our environment more so than positive. So if you have a few very loud complainers and a whole lot of quiet, happy, content people, the complainers are going to get more attention. And I'm just going to drop this John Oliver clip into the chat because I'm actually writing my lecture for next week. And this is one of the things I show to demonstrate negativity bias and how to overcome it.
Oh, great. Just for environmental stuff or for everyday life as well? Because I need some help in everyday life.
This is for environmental stuff, but it can be applied to everyday life. It's a real quick little clip. So I recommend watching it if you have a chance.
Oh, cool. Definitely. I remember going to an OPower lecture and they said that when they first did the OPower, they gave you like a smiley face or a frowny face. And then apparently people freaked out so much about the frowny face that they took the frowny face off. And now you get no face. One smiley face or two smiley faces. And I'm like, why are people so lame? It's a frowny face. Like, can they seriously not handle a frowny face? Like, what is wrong with people? Like, this is like the climate and the planet. Like, it really, really matters. And are we that lame? And it's only electricity. These are kilowatts. These aren't like human beings, like children and their future or whatever. And so they took away the frowny face. So lame that we have to get a double smiley face. And I just thought that was pathetic for everybody involved, for the people who got the frowny face and complained, for OPower, for the utility. Can't we just handle like a little, it's not personal, it's just kilowatts. Like, can't we handle a little bit of a frowny face now and then?
My observation is that utilities really don't like bad press. And if you can imagine the media getting into a frenzy over a frowny face, certainly they could and would do that. Whether or not we should put value on that, I don't know. I think probably not. But the utilities obviously do value not having the bad press.
There's so many like genuinely bad things, you know, like $80 parking fines in San Francisco is genuinely a challenge and actual hard stuff in the world. We usually seem to be able to force hard things on people when they really need to. Like, we put people in jail, we arrest people. Can't we actually give people a little bit of soft feedback? It's not even a fine. It's not like you're giving people like a $50 fine or cutting off their electricity or something that's really actually damaging. And it's not even active shaming. It's just very, very subtle. But yes, there's this enormous resistance to this subtle negative feedback, which, as you've proven in your research, is really effective.
Katie, I get your point, but just a slight perspective on that. You're being judged by PG&E in our area. Everybody hates PG&E. They think they have no credibility. They don't value them. They think they're completely off base and they just are angry at PG&E. So to be told by somebody that you don't respect and don't believe has any integrity and hate, I think that adds to it. So there is an aspect, who's giving you the frowny face, I think.
Right. So if there was like another organization that had more goodwill involved,
yes,
perhaps people would be more open to having their frowny face.
Yeah, I think if Silicon Valley Clean Energy, for example, started doing that, I don't think there would be nearly the pushback that PG&E gets.
You know, I've got to get in touch with them to issue some frowny face designs. This has been a wonderful conversation, Nicole. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you let me know what you are most excited about exploring in the future with your research?
So one of the things that I've been looking at also with Dr. Kristen Hurst, who is the main author of the paper we've been discussing. She was a former postdoc in my lab and is now faculty at Southern Illinois University. We have looked at interpersonal dynamics of sustainable decision-making. And as I'm sure you've observed, in our research field, we tend to treat decisions and behaviors as if they're always made by individuals. That's simply not how things are in the world. We think about a family getting a new car or where they're going to go on vacation, or are we going to get solar panels on our house? There is a discussion that takes place, and there are likely many discussions that take place over some period of time. And that's completely overlooked in the research, probably in part because it's very difficult research to do. But we just published a paper this month in Journal of Environmental Psychology. We show that having structured conversations about sustainability can motivate people to behave more sustainably. And we also show that depending on who you're talking to and their stance on a particular issue, that also influences how you behave after the conversation. And this is where I'm very interested in taking my research, is just thinking more about the fact that we live in a dynamic world and trying to model that. Because currently this approach of let's take one slice in time or a very short couple of slices doesn't accurately represent how things are happening in the world. And I think it's just crucial to take into account the temporal and the interpersonal dynamics of these decision processes.
It just comes up with every single person I interview who's done a paper is social conversation between two people. I started this sort of chapter of my life becoming into this really coming from a feedback of data approach. I was like, if we just show people the data in real time, it was tested with real time feedback loops. But then as I got into the real time feedback loop, I started to actually become much more qualitative in my understanding that it's these interpersonal conversations. It was interesting what you said. You said structured conversation. What is a structured conversation? What's in that?
Well, we gave people a prompt that basically led them to self-disclose. And by self-disclosing to another person in the conversation, that allowed people to kind of develop a rapport. And that was ultimately what drove the more sustainable behavior after the conversation. That's the only thing we've tried so far.
Hey, Nicole. I think this is a really interesting direction to study. And just my observation, again, having a year-long conversation with people in our area about getting solar panels and stuff like that, what I was super surprised about was we'd have these conversations. People would get on the road toward, yeah, I think this is a good idea. Yeah, we're going to make this move toward whatever, electric water heater or HVAC or something like that. And then they would have some random conversation with one of their relatives at a dinner or some friend of theirs at work, and it would totally throw them off. And I think if we weren't having these discussions in the community, I think they would have just stopped. But instead, they came back and they related that conversation. We talked about it some more, and we effectively gave them counterpoints or alternate perspectives that maybe that isn't a good objection and here's a reason why you should reconsider. And that gave them a basis to go back and have those conversations. But I was really surprised about how much weight they put on those just completely ad hoc conversations with people. And it really threw some people off completely. They just never came back. Other people, though, we gave them some basis to move forward. So I think if you could find some way to study that in a structured manner, that'd be really interesting to see what results you get.
Yeah, that's super interesting.
If we were trying to design a conversation, what would you tell me to do? What would your advice? I've got to design a conversation to get people to change their water heaters over. What should I put in that conversation?
Having them talk to someone who's not necessarily making a sales pitch, but somebody who's like pro for whatever the cause is that you're trying to promote is one good starting point. And then have the conversation be set up so that there's mutual self-disclosure and there's that opportunity to build rapport.
What do you mean by self-disclosure? Disclosing what?
Opinions, feelings, thoughts. I don't know what that is in regards to a water heater in particular. What we looked at in my study was people's thoughts about a sustainability food policy at the university. And so people talked about, you know, well, I'm a vegetarian or I like meat and I don't necessarily see a need for this policy. So it doesn't need to be like super personal, but something where you're revealing some part of yourself to another person.
It makes me think of not closely related, but sort of under the same umbrella of people who make a lot of content online. There's a sense of wanting to always come across as being professional. And then when people start to open up and say, you know, I've experienced depression or I'm on medication or I experienced this type of abuse or my house gets really messy too, or like kind of like to open up this kind of like self-disclosure of suffering. It opens up this really deep emotional connection with their audience. Because I do a lot of public content, I'm often just absorbing other people's lessons on how to build audiences and that kind of thing. And this one issue comes up, everybody says, they're like, when I just like took the armor off, I stopped trying to be professional, I was just talked about this thing that happened to me and that thing that happened to me, and then I just opened up, that's when I got really deep emotional connection with people, and, you know, my audience started to grow. So it kind of sounds like it's the same, like a little version of the same thing. Like if you just open up about something about yourself, the other person will open up, and then you'll create that bond, or basically that bridge for the information to channel through, like a tunnel.
Yeah. It's some expression of vulnerability, right?
Yeah. So, and it doesn't necessarily need to be something like, oh, like I've seen a psychiatrist for 10 years or I was abused. It can just be something little like I'm a vegan, or
it doesn't need to be
or I have a worm farm, something like that. I always tell people about my worm farm. I'm always bragging about the worms. I'm really proud.
You've got a worm farm.
Yeah, on my balcony, it's a spherical worm farm. It's like a sphere. It kind of looks like something from Star Wars, and it's on hand. And I got the worms off Amazon. So you can actually look at live worms. They come in a little bag. And they started just little, and now there's thousands of them in there now. They're prolific.
Do they have names?
No, but we do talk about them. Like we inspect them, you know, take them out. I show them to my daughter. We're looking. And there's a lot of very small ones, which means that they've been active, they're fertile, having babies. So, yeah, I mean, I do check on them with the temperature. Like it was really hot in summer and I was worried about them. So I like opened the door and put cold water on them. And I could tell that they were unhappy because they were all on the plastic surface. Like they were almost trying to get out. So I got a bit worried about them during the heat wave. So yeah, they're like little pets.
I was listening to a comedian last week and he goes, I opened up a can of worms and they're just sitting there. I'm not sure what the fuss is about.
So, exactly. You can open up not a can, but a canvas bag. They're like $15 on Amazon. They come in a couple of days, totally alive. Great little pets, very low maintenance and useful. Final question, Nicole. If you could see the field of environmental psychology and your particular interests be fully implemented in 100 years' time, where would you see everything at? What would be your ultimate solution?
This is a dreamer question. I like it. Well, I think I would like to see changes at all levels, from the individual choice level up to the policymaker and corporate levels as well. And I would also like to see science be translated into practice more. So what you're doing is amazing because it's exactly that. And I think we need more of it. And I think the only way to get to that dreamy ideal world is by doing more of what you're doing.
Thank you. Nice to have a compliment at the end of the dreamer question. And if you have any environmental psychologist friends or colleagues or networks, you know, please encourage them to get in touch with me if they want to have their research papers explored in the podcast or just want to subscribe and listen. I think I'm the only one. I'm pretty sure I'm the only one who does it. So hopefully there'll be more people who take an interest and want to sort of extrapolate this research and share it with the industry. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I hope we can get this message out to lots of environmental practitioners who will start to be a little more confident giving negative guilt-based feedback and won't be too afraid to nudge people in a negative way, which you've shown is actually a very effective way at creating behavior change.
I would love to see that as well.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of the How to Save the World podcast. It's an incredible journey to understand all of this academic research and be able to share it with this incredibly nurturing and loving community. I am thrilled to have the How to Save the World podcast partnered with some of my favorite groups in environmental design and technology. Our first partner is a group called Earth Hacks. Earth Hacks runs environmental hackathons about once a month, where they gather all sorts of technology folk, computer programmers, GIS people, designers, engineers, and just about anybody to get together for a weekend hackathon and dive into these fascinating environmental technology problems. I definitely support getting involved in Earth Hacks. If you're into technology or computers or data and the planet in any way, you will love Earth Hacks. And you can sign up and join their hackathons at earthhacks.io. Our second partner is a group called Climate Designers, run by my friends Mark and Sarah. And Climate Designers is a group bringing together all types of designers from all disciplines of design and asking the question, how can we use design to help solve climate change? They've pulled together an amazing group of people from around the world, and they hold events and a podcast, and they run a community on the platform Mighty Works. And you can sign up and join their group at climatedesigners.org. And our third partner
partner is a really cool group called Conservation X. Conservation X runs all types of innovation, challenges, and partnerships to try and invent and come up with new ways of cutting-edge technology to help with the conservation movement's greatest problems. And Conservation X has really come out of this small-scale DIY hacker put-it-together-yourself space with conservation, and it encourages people to start building their own technology. And you should jump onto their website at conservationxlabs.com to check out their current programs. And they also have a podcast that you can check out called Explore. The links to sign up to these really cool partner groups are in the show notes below. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your support. And thank you to our amazing guests who have joined us on the show. And of course, for your interest in the amazing world of environmental psychology. Now, let's get out there and make saving the world the greatest game we've ever played.